The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I think we'll go ahead and start. My name's Don Baker from the law firm of Baker and Miller, we're here to talk about something that I think is important and interesting, and we're very lucky in having senior enforcement officials to talk about it. And as was mentioned last week, the proceedings are being podcasted, so while the audience here is relatively small, the audience out in the world, I gather, is likely to be considerably larger. And once they hear how good it is, it should be absolutely huge. this subject of using criminal laws to punish cartels and so forth seems to be hugely topical. Literally yesterday, there were two stories on two leading business newspapers on the opposite sides of the Atlantic that said opposite things. one was commenting on the Justice Department. This was by a fellow named Holman Jenkins, who seems to think that the antitrust laws are a waste of time. He summarizes it saying, here's our view. At best, antitrust is a questionable form of economic regulation that places a highly speculative theory of consumer good ahead of actual non-controversial rights of producers to sell on terms of their own choosing. Justice has done itself no favor by calling in to question the reliability of amnesty processes. With its brain a little less, this is a justice's brain, a little less clouded by self-righteousness, the department might notice that its campaign to impose its dubious ideal of price regulation on the world might actually be helped if it grew up a little bit thinking about antitrust. Meanwhile, in the Financial Times of London, there was a story by John Kay talking about the 25th anniversary of the elimination of the cartel on the London Stock Exchange, in which he says, among other things, the outcome was more successful than anyone had anticipated, strongly reinforcing London's position as a world financial center and also substantially different from the future that had been foreseen. He concludes, the instinct for competitive solutions to problems of industrial structure is always the instinct for competitive solutions is always almost always sound, but the evolution of competitive markets is a process of experiment and discovery whose outcome is unpredictable. If business leaders could predict the outcome of markets, there would be no need for them. I think they mean no need for the markets, but I'm not sure. Anyway. Let me introduce my two colleagues and then say a couple of things about the process that we're going to discuss. On my right is Vincent Smith, who has been the head of competition enforcement at the Office of Fair Trading, and in the last reorganization of the place now is now called Senior Director for Competition. I'm glad you're for competition and not Senior Director against competition. But he's been in the forefront of the things we're going to be talking about. Before that, he was in the communications regulator, which is called Ofcom. And before that, he spent 10 years practicing European and UK law with a big firm of solicitors in London. On my left is Lisa Phelan, who is a, among other things, a 1986 graduate of this law school, and is a somebody who managed to last longer than I did in the Justice Department. She's been there now 20 years and has risen to the point of being the head of the National Criminal Enforcement Section. But on the way, she has tried a good many criminal cases, including a famous international one called Fax Paper, and where the government won wonderful victory on jurisdiction and then had a little trouble with the district judge when they got back, when they got back to the court. So you have the senior people from two absolutely critical institutions. Let me just put this in perspective, because I've been around longer than either of you. When I was in the government, criminal antitrust was a minority taste. And the spread of criminal statutes is a hugely interesting development, a development that reflects, I think, growing political concern about cartels and, frankly, other forms of commercial thievery. It's certainly part of a bigger picture of punishing white-collar crime or white-collar frauds criminally. And, of course, we have this landmark of Mr. Skilling being sent off to federal residence for longer than everyone else but Bernie Evers in the white-collar category. But the emergence of these new criminal laws raises many questions as they answer. Questions about policy goals, questions about enforcement methods, and questions about fundamental fairness. I think we hope to discuss some of these, and many of these are questions that don't normally get discussed. To start with, should a tough antitrust statute just apply to big enterprises running on high visibility global cartels? Or should it also apply to local real estate brokers or taxicab operators? Think about Hong Kong, which has no antitrust law and has a hugely competitive market in traded goods, but has numerous cartels in construction and other local service industries. Related to this is the question of effective enforcement. Are the politicians and governments that enact these criminal sanctions willing to appropriate enough money to make the criminal regime a practical reality rather than an occasional distraction? I think unenforced law probably is worse than none at all. And of course, for those who were around before I was around, in the U.S.
Are you in that category, Tom?
Yeah. There's a little gap between Senator Sherman and me. In the U.S., there was no enforcement funding in the first 12 years of the Sherman Act, although it had been done as a crime. And it was better part of a century before the Sherman Act became an everyday operational reality for price fixers and bid riggers. Now, most countries around the globe punish enterprises for engaging in cartels using either administrative processes as in Brussels or straight criminal remedies as in the U.S. and soon in the U.K. And the sanctions against companies have grown enormously. In the U.S. in 1973, the Sherman Act conspiracies were misdemeanors in which a company could suffer a maximum $50,000 fine. Today, these conspiracies are $100 million felonies, which I did the arithmetic is a 2,000-fold increase in 30 years, from 50,000 to 100 million. And the sentences can go even higher under the alternative sentencing scheme based on gains and losses. But enterprises are only part of the story. Isn't it also important to punish individuals, those who actually conspire with their competitors? Here, I think there's no global consensus. And even among the countries that do punish individuals, there is uncertainty, and I think debate even, about whether imprisonment is the right remedy for them. And it's been pretty damned uncommon outside the United States. I think Lisa's going to talk about what's happened in the United States. This then raises the whole question of whether price fixers have been or should be less treated less stringently than perpetrators of other premeditated white-collar frauds. Now, the embezzler may steal a large sum, which we know the exact amount, from his employer, while the price fixer often steals small sums from and which may or may not be very visible from a lot of small people. For me, both of them are theft, but should the less visible consequences somehow temper the penalties society imposes on them? If not, why are we seeing debates in so many countries about sending price fixers to jail, and yet those same countries will send swindlers off to prison? Indeed, in the U.S., the sentencing guidelines have been promulgated in part to make sure that price fixers go off to jail with other, white collar luminaries such as, Evers and the Enron folks. Anyway, to discuss these questions, we have our two experienced enforcers. The U.S. Has the oldest criminal scheme, although it took decades before it was really enforced. Meanwhile, in the U.K., Parliament has enacted in 2002 a criminal statute which applies to individuals but not to companies. I hope that each of you will talk not only about what's going on in your own country, but looking at the world comparatively, because I think we want to see the thing in perspective. I've asked Vincent, as our visitor from afar, to start off, but before he starts, I'd like to tell you one story about his agency, the Office of Fair Trading.
It's unscripted.
No, it's perfectly fine. I got in a taxi cab near Victoria Station and said to the driver, I wanted to go to thus and such address. I said, it's the Office of Fair Trading. In this wonderful Cockney accent, he said, "Oh, Governor, that's obsolete. Today it's every man for himself." So tell us about Fair Trading.
Don't know how to follow that. Thanks very much, Don. This evening I just wanted to marshal my remarks under six broad heads. I'll try and give a brief overview of what the UK framework looks like. Secondly, why we got criminalisation of cartels. Thirdly, on incentives for people to blow the whistle on cartels and how our system works and how it differs from the US system. Fourth, the fact that we can use different kinds of powers to investigate part cartels under different kinds of legal frameworks and the problems that that causes. Fifthly, I'll ask the question and try and answer it. Can the US teach the UK anything more? And finally, just a few conclusions. And these are all my own remarks rather than the Office of Fair Trading, as I declare. So firstly, the UK's competition law framework. We are both a consumer law and a competition law enforcement body. So our closest US equivalent is in fact probably the Federal Trade Commission rather than the Department of Justice. But as Don said, we do now also have the power to prosecute cartels criminally. And we get our competition powers primarily from two UK Acts of Parliament. First, the Competition Act of 1998, and that gave us the power to combat anti-competitive behaviour by firms. That's price fixing, market sharing, but also abuse of market power. We have the power to fine the firms under that statute, and the maximum extent of the fine is up to 10% of the firm's worldwide turnover, so a lot of money potentially. And these fines are civil penalties, they're not criminal law fines. Now, the second statute is the Enterprise Act of 2002, which Don mentioned in his introduction, which most importantly introduces the new criminal offence for individuals, so not firms, who are engaged in cartels. Conviction could result in a maximum of 5 years imprisonment. Three comments on framework, if I may. First, it combines both civil and criminal enforcement powers and in one agency, so we can both prosecute and pursue cartels civilly. And the Competition Act regime, the civil regime, is an administrative law one. It's modelled on the EU system, which grew out of French and German administrative law. So effectively, it's a continental import into English law. The Enterprise Act, by contrast, is very much a piece of common law. It's modelled on the common law, creates a new indictable offence. That's our version of a felony. And so we do have interface issues between those two regimes. Second, the regime is very complex. There are three main competition enforcement bodies in the UK. The OFT, the main one. The Competition Appeal Tribunal, which as its name suggests is the appeal body. And thirdly, a body... a body called the Competition Commission, which is effectively a body which looks at the functioning of markets as a whole and is a referral body from us. Now, there are also a number of industry regulators, our equivalent of people like the Federal Communications Commission and so on. We have them for the energy sector, for communications, that's telecoms and broadcasting, for the railways, which you probably don't have here, air traffic control, which I'm sure you do have, and they also use the Competition Act powers. So there are a number of different bodies who apply the same law in parallel with each other. Now, what fortunately, at least, we don't currently have, but I suspect it will come, is the overlay of an active plaintiff bar pursuing these people for private ends in the civil courts. But we do have the equivalent of a state against federal interface, because we work closely with the European Commission, which is not quite a federal body yet, though it would like to be one, and applies the same kind of law at a European level as we apply at a national level. My third comment is, as Don said, it's all brand new. So the Competition Act came into force in March of 2000, and the Enterprise Act came into force in June of 2003. You compare that with the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act, and you can see that we've got a learning curve which is fairly steep. So moving on to my second theme, why did we get criminalisation? The parliamentary debate which preceded the Enterprise Act focused on deterrence as being the main reason for the introduction of the criminal cartel offence.
Sure.
Sorry, can everyone hear me now? Sorry.
You're
that's
podcasting,
better.
Remember.
My podcasting is probably a big silence. Never mind. The parliamentary debate which preceded the Enterprise Act focused on deterrence as being the main reason for the introduction of criminalisation for cartels. And we modelled ourselves consciously on US practice. So why was that? Well, I think there were a number of reasons. First, that the level of civil penalties was felt to be an unsatisfactory deterrent. Civil sanctions on corporations are not sufficient to deter cartel activity. There are statutory limits on fines, and the appeal courts do reduce the fines, which meant that the actual amount of the civil fine was almost always far below the gain profit from which the firm got from the cartel activity. Just to take one example, we fined a number of retailers who sold replica soccer shirts, which was a price-fixing case, in 2003. The harm to consumers was estimated at more than £59 million in that case. Now, we imposed a fine of £18 million, which is about a quarter of the gain, but it was subsequently reduced on appeal to £14.5 million for reasons which were not entirely clear. So financial penalties do need to substantially exceed the cartel profit gain, which therefore needs to be a significant multiple of that gain in order to deter companies from the anti-competitive conduct, because we can't detect all cartels. And there's been a suggestion that you probably have to fine companies 150% or more of their annual turnover to actually deter them properly. Now, of course, here the plaintiff bar performs some of that function for you, which is, and of course, spurred on by the availability of treble damages, which we don't have for cartel infringements in the UK. Now, why? So we needed to target the individuals, and until 2003, with a very few exceptions, individuals had no liability at all for their conduct under competition law in the UK. I think we had here what the economists in my agency call an agency issue, that is that the directors and managers of the companies have different incentives from the shareholders. They, who are the people who after all carry out the cartel, don't suffer the consequences of the infringement. Profits are increased, their bonuses may increase, they themselves trouser the money. They then move on to another company, we find out about it, find the company and the shareholders suffer, as well as consumers. So we felt we needed some form of sanction on individuals. We felt that criminal sanctions were required. They have a greater fear factor for managers than the previous civil-only sanctions and are a greater deterrent. They also serve to incentivize an individual to come in and expose a cartel in return for a grant of leniency. So what are the incentives in the UK on people to blow the whistle on a cartel? Well, on the criminal side, because cartels are secret, we feel, and I'm sure the DOJ will support this, that the best information to detect a cartel is for someone to actually tell us all about it, who was in it. Now, we don't have a plea bargain system in the UK. There is no such thing as a plea bargain. So the discretion that we have to bring a case or not is limited. The court retains a full discretion if there is a guilty sentence. A guilty plea to sentence. We can't actually do a deal with the defendant which is binding on the court.
You can't give them immunity?
We can exercise a discretion not to prosecute at all, which is what we do, but it's a 0-1 game. Either we prosecute them, if they get prosecuted, they get convicted, it's up to the judge, or we don't. And that's basically it. So we do this by exercising our discretion not to prosecute, and we call them this exercise of a discretion a no-action letter. We send a letter to the individual informing them that we won't prosecute them for the cartel offence and describing what we think the offence is in return for their full cooperation. Now, we hope to make sure that the incentives of the executives are aligned with those of the firm. So the way in which we give no action letters parallels the leniency program, the similar leniency program we have under our civil regime, which gives companies either a reduction in the civil penalties I mentioned, or if they come forward first, lets them off the penalties altogether. We do try also and use other detection tools. In particular, we are concerned that leniency programs might uncover, particularly if they are corporate ones rather than individual ones, end-of-life cartels, rather than those which are, as it were, in full flow. And of course those are the ones that have already done the damage to consumers. So in the absence of an active plaintiff bar, there's not a lot that the consumers can do about it. So we are thinking about other ways of incentivising individuals and companies to come forward at an early stage. We haven't got very much further in our thinking. I'd be interested to hear what Lisa has to say about how the DOJ manages to incentivise people to come forward as they do, rather earlier on than we can manage. What are then the disincentives to blowing the whistle? Well, firstly, that the individual, of course, has to admit the participation in the relevant offence so that we can use that admission in evidence against the co-conspirators should the matter come to trial. Now, there may be some hesitation in actually making that admission before there is certainty as to whether or not we will prosecute. We do try then to give them some degree or a significant substantial degree of absolute certainty before the admission is made, but we have to be clear that the admission will be made, so it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, therefore, given the shortcomings of our system. But we are not allowed, and we make a promise not to, but we are not allowed to use any information voluntarily given to us by an individual or the admission made in a prosecution against the individual themselves. So that evidence would be set to one side if we did subsequently prosecute. Another possible disincentive is that the no action letter doesn't, on its face, offer that individual immunity from related criminal offences. And some which have been put to us as possibilities are money laundering, false accounting, or conspiracy to defraud. And I'll come on to those in a minute. Now, the fact that an individual could theoretically be prosecuted for those ancillary offences might be a deterrent, but I think that if an individual came forward and we gave them a no-action letter, if some other agency attempted to prosecute them, say, for some form of money laundering or possibly even revenue fraud, that prosecution will probably be thrown out on the grounds that it will be an abuse of process. because the person came forward and volunteered the information to us. Now, we do have one further weapon, which the Enterprise Act gave us, which is rather novel. We can now apply to the civil courts, the High Court, for an order disqualifying the individual from being a director or manager of a company. And, of course, for individuals, that can be quite a serious career-shortening move. And that can be for a period of anything up to 15 years, depending on how serious the cartel behaviour was. That's practically a lifetime ban on running a company for some people. We can, if people offer it to us, and I suspect they will going forward, actually take a voluntary undertaking, possibly for a shorter period than would otherwise be imposed by a court, not to act as a director or manager. So we might be able to parcel that up as part of our leniency program and say we will not take action against you under the disqualification powers if you give us such an offer. So turning then to the fourth of my heads, this mix of regimes, the criminalisation and the Civil Competition Act regime and the problems that it gives. We do run cases in parallel, so the fuel surcharges case that Don mentioned is actually being run at the moment as a potential criminal case and a potential civil case. We've discussed what the deterrent and reputation effects of criminal sanctions are, but we do, I think, feel that we also need to pursue the companies involved, and we can only do that using our civil powers because the criminal offence of the Enterprise Act does not apply to corporations.
Can I interrupt you to ask a question? Is there any problem with sharing documents between the civil side and criminal side in your system?
Yes.
Short answer, yes. Okay.
I'll come on to that if I may in a minute.
Okay.
We think that certain types of cartel are more likely to meet the criminal standard of proof than others, and some of those that meet the civil standard of proof shouldn't just escape because they don't meet the criminal standard. Information exchanging between competitors, which doesn't quite amount to price fixing, is that kind of thing. It doesn't quite amount to naked price fixing. It's nevertheless quite serious and needs to be pursued. And most non-price fixing or market sharing cartels, therefore, are not within the scope of the Enterprise Act cartel offence. And I think that's different from the US system, where the Sherman Act is broadly cast and can catch most things. Our criminal offence is actually quite narrow in many respects. Coming on to Lisa's point, what do we do if you've got some evidence, say, in a civil case from the company which incriminates someone? Clearly we can use that as the basis to begin a criminal investigation, but we cannot use it, I think, as evidence in the criminal case, so we would have to actually re-serve and restart the investigation in the criminal case to make sure that the evidence collected in the criminal case was collected to the criminal law standard, which is governed by a statute in the UK called the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, largely. The other way round is easier, because if we get criminal, or if we've got a criminal investigation, and the evidence that we've acquired under the criminal investigation implicates a company in a civil infringement of the Competition Act, then that evidence has already been collected to the standard required for a Competition Act case. We can then use it already in evidence, and there is no limitation on us doing so, although we have to consider the rights of the defence. We can use that in evidence against the company. So it is in fact likely, going forward, although this hasn't happened so far, for us to be more open and willing to accept leniency applications from individuals than from companies, because the individuals can give us evidence which we can then use against the company. We also have the nexus between criminalisation in the UK and European competition law, which is all civil. The European Commission, which is the body that administers European competition law, has no criminal law powers because the member states have not given the European Union criminal jurisdiction. So we've arranged with the European Commission that we will coordinate our no action letter programme with their federal level, if you like, civil leniency programme, so that if they've offered leniency at a European level, we will in most cases be prepared to grant executives of the companies who've got European leniency a no action letter in respect of any UK offences they may have committed. Just another quick word on information disclosure, since Lisa raised it. We've been part of something called the European Competition Network since the 1st of May 2004, because since that date the European Union has devolved quite a lot of its European law enforcement powers to us. So we've actually had three changes of law in the last 5 years, rather a lot going on with. Now the trouble which we have is that only a very small minority of EU countries have criminal sanctions for competition cases. It's us and the Irish, basically. So all of the rest have only civil enforcement, and they do not want the evidence that they collect, which comes into this European competition network, and which is exchanged between the 25 member states of the European Union, to be used to prosecute individuals in their country. So there is an issue there about us not being able to see all of the evidence, potentially, that is available in European-wide cartels because of the concerns that some countries have about the criminalisation of cartels in their member states. So looking ahead, it's rather unclear whether national competition authorities in Europe will cooperate with us as fully as they might otherwise do so when we're looking for evidence of a criminal cartel. And I think that is one of the areas we need to look at quite closely going forward. So my fifth head, is there anything more that the US can teach us? Well, as I said earlier, our Enterprise Act criminal cartel offence is actually modelled on US practice to a significant extent. What we don't have is a fully fledged amnesty and plea bargain system as the DOJ does. One of the issues we do need to think about is whether in the next few years we can try and push the courts in particular, the criminal courts, into developing further a plea bargain system along the US lines. I'd have to say that I think it's an uphill struggle because it will be difficult to do that just for antitrust in isolation. You would need to do it for most of the similar kinds of offences which are prosecuted, and in particular most of the fraud-related offences and dishonesty-related offences, so securities fraud, possibly even money laundering, certainly conspiracy to defraud. All of those kinds of offences are of an equivalent kind to the antitrust cartel offence that we have in the Enterprise Act, and therefore you need to have a plea bargain system which applied across the piece. The second thing that we're thinking of doing, which is an import from the US Amnesty and Leniency Program, is to have what is called a marker system. At the present, particularly in Europe, in order to get the benefit of the promise not to be pursued, you have to bring all your evidence up front, allow the authority, the European Commission, to look at it, and then they will give you the promise. Now, the DOJ, of course, says, right, if you will promise us that you will come good on your offer, we will take your promise as being sufficient for the time being for you to get leniency or amnesty, as the case may be, provided that within a short period of time afterwards you actually produce the evidence, produce the witnesses, and give a full cooperation, full admission of a guilt. I believe that would be fair to say.
Yeah.
We're hoping to be able to do that in the UK, at least for the criminal offence, possibly also civilly, although the European Union doesn't like us doing that for reasons which escape me. So it is actually a lot more effective than what we have, and that, I hope, will make our leniency program more effective. We're also looking closely at the Stolt-Nielsen case, because of course that might impact, particularly if it's imported across the Atlantic, the discretion we have, if we do introduce a marker system, as to when one can withdraw the marker. And I think that is something which I hope perhaps Lisa will comment on in a minute.
I think because it's ongoing, I can't say much.
Okay.
I will say things.
Yeah, you can feel free to say things. I think I better not.
Because we don't have a marker system at the moment, we require them to produce the evidence before we give them, before we come clear on our promise of leniency. The issue doesn't really arise. But if we brought in a marker system, what Stolt-Nielsen will teach us about when we can withdraw the marker will be very instructive, I think.
Just stop for everyone's benefit. Stolt-Nielsen was the first time in the history of the Justice Department's amnesty program, going back 11 years, in which the government had withdrawn an amnesty application, an amnesty grant, because the party that came in didn't stop doing it. After discovering it, they let it ride on until there was a story in the Wall Street Journal. And so then when it was withdrawn, they went to court. Stolt-Nielsen, the Norwegian firm, went to court, got an injunction against the government prosecuting them, which went up to the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which held that the proper remedy for breach of an amnesty agreement was to challenge the indictment after it had been brought. Stolt-Nielsen has now petitioned the Supreme Court and got everybody and his dog
filing amicus briefs and support of them. Stolt-Nielsen's position is, in fact, fairly novel. The normal rule in other criminal areas has been that amnesty, disputes over amnesty agreements are to be challenged after indictment.
And in the meantime, it is now after indictment as well.
After the Supreme Court refused to enjoin the government indicted the bastards.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Don.
anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
There are those who think that was a bit unfair, but they were particularly from Norway. Whilst we're on the subject of people from not within the US, a couple of words, if I may, on extradition.
A very hot topic in the UK.
Extremely. Particularly because of the NatWest three, who you may have read about in the press, who were implicated in the Enron affair and who have been extradited to the court in Houston to stand trial. Now, the criminal cartel offence is extraditable. So it will be possible for individuals to be extradited both to and from the UK to face similar charges abroad, or if they've committed the cartel offence, to come to the UK and be charged. The UK's extradition treaty with the US, which has still not been ratified by the Senate, hinges on dual criminality. So the conduct must be punishable in both jurisdictions on an equivalent basis before the extradition treaty works. So that would suggest that conduct which occurred before the June 2003 can't be subject to an extradition warrant. Wrong. In the case of Norris and the United States, the lack of a criminal cartel offence, or the lack of the criminal cartel offence, was held not to be a barrier to extradition of Mr. Norris. He was a former chief executive of an engineering company called Morgan Crucible, which had been engaged in price fixing in the UK. Now, at the time, price fixing was not part of the cartel offence at the time he did it, which was in the late 80s and early 90s. And so therefore, it was thought by Mr. Norris, amongst others, that the dual criminality hurdle was a bar to him being extradited. Now, the Crown Prosecution Service, I think somewhat assisted by us, and on behalf of the US government, argued that price fixing was tantamount to the common law offence of conspiracy to defraud. That's been available, I think the first case of it was in the 1840s, so it's been around for at least 150 years. And the judge who heard the application agreed with the US and ordered Mr. Norris to be extradited.
That's what we're going for now. We're fixing that legislation soon.
He lost his appeal. He went to the Court of Appeal on the point about dual criminality, and they refused the petition, so he lost on appeal. And the House of Lords has refused to hear it on the grounds that there is no point of law of public importance. They felt that the point was clear enough for them not to need to hear it. He's thinking about going to the European Court of Human Rights, and there is a question of fact still as to whether the judge erred in fact in holding that the. That conspiracy to defraud, as defined, was in fact equivalent to the US Sherman Act, but that I think was heard last week or the week before, and there's judgment pending. So I wasn't not entirely aware of what's happened there. I suspect that Mr. Norris lost. So finally, a few conclusions, leaving extradition on one side. Firstly, criminalisation has significantly altered how we at the OFT conduct our cartel investigations because of the higher evidential burden which we need to. Sustain in order to bring a criminal case as against a civil case. In particular, we now use a lot more witness and oral evidence than we did before because the civil case is largely document-based. We use large files of documents, or used to. We now use witness statements and oral evidence more. It's also increased our cooperation with other law enforcement agencies, not least the DOJ, but also domestically, the Serious Fraud Office. We work closely with the UK Serious Fraud Office, which is the body which prosecutes most major corporate frauds in the UK. So a few thoughts looking forward. We think that there does need to be a real threat of enforcement of the criminal cartel offence. The Enterprise Act has only been enforced since June 2003, and it can only apply to behaviour occurring after that date, although, as I said, we might have the possibility of using slightly different charges in some cases. So we haven't yet brought any prosecutions, unsurprisingly. But we have started using our criminal powers, and we are investigating two criminal cases, the passenger fuel surcharges case, and also some bid rigging in some fairly major, hospital contracts in the construction sector. Another crucial element to the success of the cartel offence is the willingness of the courts actually to sentence the offenders to a term of imprisonment rather than simply fining them. And I think that the US experience in its early years, where individuals were fined or given suspended sentences, is probably going to be repeated in the UK for a while until people get used to the idea that this is really a fraud and should be punished as such. So it may be that people will prefer to be prosecuted by us than by the DOJ, which I can't say I blame them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Benson. Well, Lisa, before just to show I'm even-handed, I'll tell a story. I'll tell a story about your agency.
Uh-oh.
No, it's perfectly nice. Perfectly nice story. I came back to the Justice Department to be head of the agency the week after I lost a case in the Supreme Court. And I was greeted by my friend, the director of operations, said, "You know, Don, if you were really interested in serving the public interest, you'd just stay out there in the private sector
and keep on losing."
Anyway, we're really happy to have you. And I think Vincent's given us enough things to talk comparatively about.
Absolutely. And I'm really happy to be here, not only because it's a pleasure to be on the panel with another speaker who's jurisdiction has seen the light and come around to believe they should model themselves on the U.S., which the U.S. is always happy to have countries do. But as Don said at the beginning, I am a WCL alum, and so I'm excited to be invited back here. I took antitrust and advanced antitrust here at WCL with Professor Jim May, who I think is still around, and if you guys have a chance to take a course with him, I would recommend it. And I was also his research intern and spent many, many an hour down at the Library of Congress trying to find newspaper articles on the cartel, the oil and railroad cartels from the turn of the century, digging through 100-year-old newspapers to find out about the active period shortly after the passage of the Sherman Act. But then, as Don has indicated, there was pretty much of a lull in terms of especially criminal enforcement for quite a few decades. So I always was interested in my criminal procedures class and my crim law classes. So when I was third year at WCL, I applied to the Attorney General's Honors Program, and you had to pick which division you wanted to work at if you got hired. And so I debated, and I put criminal division first, antitrust division second. Tough call, but I did it. And then, wouldn't you know, criminal division wasn't hiring that year. Antitrust division was. They offered me a job. I took it. But I'm thinking, oh, a lifetime of mergers. To my happy surprise, I was immediately assigned to a national criminal grand jury investigation and realized that criminal antitrust is probably the most exciting legal work out there. And after a decade or so of doing national criminal cases, we really got into the international cartel cases, and the whole practice just changed again and exploded in interest because it was so fascinating to figure out how to gather the evidence, how to put these cases together, and how to work cooperatively with so many jurisdictions, with so many different laws, agency types, regulatory schemes, cultural views about whether or not this should be a crime and whether or not they should help us put people in jail for doing it. So some of my work at the Antitrust Division, in addition to bringing lots of international cartel cases, has been working and coordinating with jurisdictions around the world, which has been fascinating to sort of gradually, I think we're building towards a consensus that this is really bad conduct. This is really bad conduct that hurts consumers, it hurts businesses, it hurts economies, it hurts everybody. And I agree with the point Don made. While the pickpocket taking your wallet out of your pocket feels very tangible and very real, and it was your $60, these international cartels take millions and millions and in some cases billions of dollars one by one out of each of our wallets. And the fact that they don't, that they can sit in a smoke-filled room in a Paris hotel and decide to do it, to me does not make it any less pernicious or evil or something that needs to be punished criminally. Just to give you an idea of the economic harm that criminal cartels are doing, in the past decade, U.S. Antitrust Division has collected more than $3 billion in criminal fines, which, considering we typically get about 10%, we figure 10% overcharge and 10%, you get a sense of how many billions of dollars of commerce have been affected, and that's just the ones we're catching. We've brought cases in industries like vitamins, computer chips, diamonds, all sorts of chemicals, textiles, construction. And as Vincent mentioned, as I can mention it, even though it's ongoing, it's been in the newspaper, both our agencies are looking at the air cargo industry. That industry does about $45 billion in commerce each year. So this is important stuff. This is affecting all of us. And we have at the Antitrust Division over 100 attorneys dedicated full-time to doing criminal antitrust. And in addition to that, we treat this like any other crime. We work with the FBI. We work, if it involves fraud on Department of Defense, we work with DCIS agents, Defense Criminal Investigative Services. And we bring all the same tools to the table, like search warrants, like consensual monitoring, and we just recently got authority to use wiretapping to investigate this crime. We put people on border watches, so if international cartel members land at JFK or land at San Francisco Airport, we find out immediately, and we get an agent out there. They're served with a subpoena. They're questioned. If they end up getting indicted, they're put on Interpol red notice, which means that you travel to any country, you could be stopped and held in prison while that country decides whether or not it would extradite you. We take these crimes very seriously. Now, that, as Don indicated, that hasn't always been true. As he said, it wasn't until 1974 that the fine for this, that it even became a felony, and that the fine went up to $1 million. In 1990, the maximum fine level was increased to $10 million. And individuals could get up to 3 years in jail, but I got to tell you, the reality, because I was practicing at that time, was it was very hard to get judges, courts, to put people in jail once they were convicted. The judge figured, this guy looks like buddies of mine down at the country club. You know, what good is it going to do sending him to prison? They would get probation. They would get community service.
Very remorseful.
You feel so bad, and, you know, if this happens, you know, I actually had one defendant, a president of a unit at Gannett Corporation, submit a letter saying, my wife and I both have his and hers BMWs, and one of us is going to have to sell one if I have to pay this fine. You know, and I was like, okay, this is terrible. This is horrible. So even though on the books we could potentially get 3 years in prison, it really wasn't happening. And we have always been absolute true believers that no matter how high the fines get, it's still just money. It's still the cost of doing business. If they can get it, they just sort of make a cost-benefit analysis if they think they're going to get away with it. And then the worst that could happen is the company would have to pay some money. But if you talk about putting executives who have, you know, standing in the community and big salaries, and you're going to put them in jail for any amount of time, you get their attention, and they do think twice. So the biggest boon for us in helping to make sure they really got jail time was the sentencing guidelines, which were put in place to make sure there was some proportionality between the sentences that folks were getting for different types of crime and in different areas around the country. And luckily for antitrust, it pretty much the offense level that was given plus additions for the volume of commerce, which kind of addresses the point Don was saying, should small companies also be punished, or should we only be going after the big international cartels if they do this kind of conduct? The beauty of the sentencing guidelines is it sort of gives that proportionality. You still are guilty of the offense, but your offense level goes up based on the volume of commerce you're affecting. So if you're a little road builder in Fairfax County, Virginia, and you rigged a $10,000 job, then you're not going to get any points added for that small volume of commerce. If you're a vitamins cartelist and, you know, you price fixed on $200 billion worth of vitamins, your number's going to shoot up, and that the fine is going to reflect that, and the potential jail term is going to reflect that. So the beauty of the sentencing guidelines for antitrust is it gives that proportionality to both, and it justifies us prosecuting small and large cartels, and they'll be treated fairly and appropriately. So the sentencing guidelines meant finally in the 1990s we started getting jail time. And as Vincent said, it's a slow evolution, though, and so we get 3 months, 4 months, 5 months jail time. And gradually judges started catching on that, hey, this is real crime. Then we were sort of helped, I think, by the whole Enron white-collar crime is bad era of 2 or 3 years ago, when suddenly people realized, hey, this is bad stuff. This is hurting a lot of people. It is destroying companies. It's destroying workers' lives. It's destroying people's retirement. It's having a lot of negative effect. And just because it's white-collar doesn't mean we shouldn't punish it severely. So it was ripe timing for the antitrust division to work with Congress to raise the penalties, the criminal penalties, yet again. And now the maximum fine is $100 million, although we can exceed that, as Don made reference to. There's a statute that says in the alternative we could get twice the gain or twice the loss. And so if you know, we can prove that significantly more harm than $100 million was done, we can get a much higher fine, and have gotten a $500 million fine, for example, in the vitamins cartel case. But most importantly, the jail term was raised to 10 years potential in jail. And while that was very, very helpful, even more helpful was the sentencing guidelines in 2005 were proportionally revised so that the offense level went up higher, the starting base offense level went up higher to now a level where really the judges are going to have a hard time not giving the person at least 12 months in jail. And with the volume of commerce factored in, that can easily get the member of a large international cartel who does not avail themselves of amnesty and isn't second in the door to plea bargain a very, very high jail term. And just to give you an idea how things have been evolving, the average jail term in the mid-1990s for our convicted felons was 8 months in prison. I mean, some higher, some lower. The average was 8 months. For 2005, the average jail term for antitrust defendants was 24 months, 2 years, which, you know, still is not a Jeffrey Skillings, but but we're getting there, and it's very good progress. And that those really reflect before the new guidelines kicked in and before the higher statutory max kicked in. So we expect those numbers to keep going up. And to give you another perspective, a statistic I mentioned to Don earlier, in the last 5 years, defendants in antitrust division cases have been given over 100 years of jail time. That's adding together those that we prosecuted in the last 5 years. And to put that in a little perspective, that number far exceeds the total if you put the 110 years before that that the Sherman Act existed. You put together all the jail time that people were sentenced to, 100 years far exceeds it. So, why is that a statistic I'm proud of, and why do I think getting big jail terms is important? Because for several reasons. We have been told directly you could guess that the threat of jail would be a deterrent. I mean, it sort of seems intuitively nobody wants to go to jail. But we have been directly told in plea negotiations and in other settings by defendants and counsel that, you know, the reason they did or didn't do certain things was because they were fearful of detection in the U.S. We have been told, and we do a lot of taping now, consensual monitoring, and soon to be done wiretapping. So we actually have tape recordings of actual cartel price-fixing meetings and bid-rigging meetings. And on the tapes, we've actually heard the cartelists, you know, laughing or joking of, we better not do this in the U.S. because we could end up in jail, you know. And we've also seen documents and had witnesses who ended up cooperating with us tell us that in global conspiracies, where they would get together and meet all over the world to discuss prices to be charged for their products all over the world, in some cases they specifically said, let's not, we're not going to fix the price for U.S. customers because that could land us in jail. So they would sit down and make big charts and fix the price of everywhere else in the world, but not the U.S. So that tells me what's different about the U.S. We have very strong individual criminal sanctions. And we are having a deterrent effect. I call my next section "The World Comes Along." we have been out proselytizing to the rest of the international law enforcement community that you need to protect your consumers, you need to protect your businesses, because you know a lot of these products are interim products; they're not sold directly to the consumer; they're sold to other businesses. So that business is harmed by having to pay too much money, and then they, in turn, either pass it on to the consumer or have to absorb it and maybe hurt and go out of business. I did one trial in the fax paper case. I did a couple of trials, but one of the ones we did, I literally had, I guess, fax paper. None of us even remember it because you remember the thermal curly kind, the shiny curly kind. Some of you are too young to remember. That was what it was. This is a case I did back in the early 90s. The first one, and it was sold in huge, I don't know what you call them, sheets, and then it was sold to companies called converters, who cut it down into the size that you would buy at Staples or Office Depot. So this converter was my victim witness, who was testifying at trial, and you know, I said to him, did this harm your business? Was it hard for you when you had to absorb? They had raised the prices 20%. Everybody had agreed to raise them, so he had no choices. He had no other way to get this product. And his whole business was converting it to the smaller sizes and selling it to Staples and Office Depot. And it doesn't happen a lot in antitrust cases, but he broke down and cried. And he said, yes, it was Christmas time. I had to lay off 100 people. We had to close one of our factories, because we just couldn't afford to pay these higher prices and still run our machines and still pay our people. I mean, this conduct hurts people. It hurts not just individual consumers, but it hurts businesses. And I think that sense and that realization is gradually spreading around the world, and people are realizing that. The OECD, in its Hardcore Cartel Report of 2005, likewise recommended that governments should seriously consider criminal sanctions, as it is the strongest form of deterrence. The UK, happily, is quickly coming along and coming up to speed, and several other countries are also adopting criminal laws. Australia has, and other countries had them on the books but really weren't enforcing them. Ireland, Israel, Japan, Korea have really reinvigorated their criminal law enforcement. Canada has for quite a while been a partner with us. They have criminal antitrust sanctions as well. And it's really kind of amazing. In 1999, the antitrust division thought, well, you know, if we're all trying to enforce these laws, there needs to be, it would be helpful if we could all have somewhat consistent systems, because to the extent the systems are different, we might not understand each other, we might not be willing to help each other, we might feel that under our system we can't share documents, we can't assist each other, there isn't dual criminality, so we can't extradite or send documents to you. So we started a series of annual conferences. The first one was held in Washington, D.C., and it was attended by antitrust enforcement authorities from 25 countries around the world. That is now held annually, and it rotates to different cities and countries around the world. There will be one held next month in The Hague, and it's expected to have, I think, 50 countries sending representatives in attendance. This has greatly expanded the communication between different antitrust authorities. I think it's led to more convergence of what are the best practices. Many countries have started changing their laws or regulations. Countries that aren't ready to criminalize, have a specific antitrust criminal statute, have found ways to interpret laws that they already have, such as fraud or fraud on the government type statutes, to feel that they they can justify exchanging information with us or assisting us because they have a comparable law, even if it isn't exactly the same as ours. And it's just led to a lot more informal communication, people knowing each other from all the different jurisdictions. And the idea is, why we want to do that is so that we want to create a world where there's no safe havens for this kind of conduct. You know, there's no, Don made mention of the fax paper cases that I did, and the U.S. versus Nippon was an important decision, I think, for all of us in the sense that it was a First Circuit District Court opinion. The District Court had dismissed the case, saying what the facts were was that 12 paper manufacturers had sat in Tokyo and agreed on prices to the U.S. and other jurisdictions. The defendant said, well, you can't prosecute that because they weren't in the United States when they had the meeting, so you have no jurisdiction to prosecute that crime. The District Court agreed with them and dismissed the case. We appealed it to the First Circuit, and the First Circuit, in an excellent opinion, said just, you know, the mere happenstance of where you hold the meeting is not relevant to whether or not the United States can protect its consumers. The test is whether or not wherever people were sitting in the world, they intended to harm U.S. consumers. And if they sat on a boat in the middle of the ocean and agreed that they were going to raise prices to U.S. consumers, then U.S. Government and courts can prosecute that. So to the extent more countries agree that this conduct is bad, are willing to help us get evidence, get the perpetrators, and that not only do these folks be deterred from having their meetings in the U.S. or price fixing regarding U.S. prices, they should come to feel that way about the whole world. That's our ultimate goal, and that's where we're heading. And we hope that the things that we've been doing in recent years will get us there, and our continuing coordination with our friends around the world will get us there as well.
Quick question for you, Lisa. Have people been sent to jail outside the U.S.?
People that are from outside the U.S.?
Sent to jail for antitrust.
Have foreign nationals living in foreign, in other words, have other courts convicted them? Yes, the answer is in Israel recently, four different executives were convicted and sentenced to between 4 and 8 months in prison each. And in Ireland, there was a recent conviction. And Vincent, do you know if there was a jail term issued?
I'm not sure that they've been sentenced yet.
They may not have been sentenced yet. But it's beginning to happen.
It is an interesting development. Vincent, in the course of your discussion, you mentioned the possibility of individuals getting no action letters for providing evidence against their employers and others. To what extent has the UK had to face up to the problem that's been very important in the US practice of providing individuals with individual representation or insisting on individuals having individual representation because of the conflict that the individual can get off in a way that the company can't.
In the cases we have at the moment, all of the individuals are separately represented, and they have criminal lawyers who represent them, mainly because the antitrust bar in the UK has not got any experience at all of criminal law, and so they're not competent actually to represent the individuals to do that. I think going forward, as the antitrust bar gets more confident in its criminal law capability, there might become an issue in terms of people representing both individuals and companies, where the company's interests differ from the individual, particularly where the individual's got a leniency or no action letter and the company hasn't, where the individual's got an incentive and indeed a requirement to tell us what has happened and the company doesn't know what's going on. I think that the the rules in the UK, the professional rules, are quite clear that where there is a risk of divergence of interest, then the people need separate representation. We'd hope that the Law Society and others would enforce that.
In the U.S., the government's pretty insistent.
Yeah, we usually quickly tell the corporate counsel that they have a conflict, that the individual executive's interests may be quite different than the corporation's, and that we expect them to move quickly and get separate counsel. And typically they do. Once in a while, someone will resist and want those billings, but typically they do.
One of the sort of controversial issues of the day is that I think it's other parts of the Department of Justice have been settling with corporations on the grounds that they would not pay the individual's legal fees. Do you have any of those kinds of settlements?
No. What Don's referring to is something. There's something called the Thompson Memorandum in the Department of Justice, and that was at the time that the Criminal Division and U.S. Attorney's Office were trying to figure out new and better ways to sort of crack down on white-collar criminals and get evidence. They weren't clever enough to think up our amnesty programs. Their sort of comparable program is a little inconsistent with our theory and our amnesty program, because it seems to sort of encourage corporations to throw the individuals under the bus and to the corporation has the potential to get a pass on prosecution if they pretty much give up all the evidence on the individuals, don't pay the individuals' counsel fees, and waive privilege is another requirement that they ask for that we don't under our amnesty program. And since we're prosecuting a different statute, we have our amnesty program. We find it a more effective strategy to potentially give both the company and the individuals a pass under our amnesty program if everyone fully cooperates. And so we have not felt the need to or have imposed those kind of requirements of not paying for counsel fees or the one about waiving privilege. But we also, together with prosecuting the Sherman Act, Title 15, we sometimes prosecute Title 18 offenses, or sometimes we begin investigating and realize it really is a Title 18 offense. I won't say there never would come a day that the Antitrust Division might do that, but we're fairly loath to do that because, as I said, it's sort of inconsistent with our concept.
I take it that Her Majesty's government in its various forms doesn't insist that the corporations not paying individuals.
It's becoming increasingly common, particularly for large companies, directors, to have liability insurance in their own name. Of course, unless they've been completely dishonest and or misled their insurers, their insurers will probably pay for their legal representation, so they get legal expenses insurance. I'm not quite sure how far we would have to push the insurers to stop them paying the executives' legal expenses, because, of course, there are limits on these insurance policies, and often they don't cover offences of dishonesty, which, of course, the cartel offence is. But nevertheless, there is quite a strong possibility that the directors' insurers will have insurance for legal fees. The companies can't pay the fines. That's unlawful in the UK. There's a piece of the company's legislation which says you can't do that.
Your last comment is sort of interesting. When I was head of the Antitrust Division, I made a big deal about locking people up and indicting a lot of individuals. And did more speech making and got less jail time than in the modern world. But I came out, and a man who went on to be the chairman of one of the largest financial institutions in the world, and was a friend, said to me, "Don, you've got it absolutely right. As long as we're only talking about money, somehow the company can take care of me. But if you start talking about taking away my liberty, there's nothing that they can do, and that's what's critical." And it was very interesting. I quoted him in a Law Review article, but never identified him. And then I found that various Antitrust Division alumni used that quote.
Should have patented it while you entered.
Yeah, right, in their thing.
Vincent, we have an investigational institution that we borrowed from England, which namely this grand jury system of secret sessions and no lawyers present.
Which we abandoned about 150 years ago.
I understand
that,
and I once had the British economic attaché, a very elegant man, in fact, appear in my office explaining to me how we had this institution that came right out of Henry VIII's and Star Chamber, and that it was really just barbaric. And of course, we guaranteed it in the Constitution, because in the Bill of Rights, because back in the colonial period, grand juries would refuse to indict people for publishing things that they'd obviously published and so on. Anyway, can you tell us just a little bit about, you talked about having more oral evidence. Mm. How do you actually go about taking that evidence?
Normally, we invite the witnesses we think we need to listen to come in. Typically, they will be people either who are requested, quotes, to do so by their employers, or who have come in to us and got a no action letter. They will come in and voluntarily give us a statement which is recorded, and we would also record it on tape, and also we take a written transcript of it. And the transcript is put in the form of a witness statement, which is sworn. That witness statement is then used as the basis for our counsel, should the thing come to trial, to examine the witness in court. Now, normally, because...
Vincent, can I just interrupt for a second, just so I understand? You tape record it, you make a transcript, and does the witness actually, like, sign that this transcript is accurate?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then that is used by our counsel, were we to bring the thing to trial, as the basis for the examination. Now, normally, what happens is that the written pieces of paper are used, treated as being accurate, unless someone wants to take a point orally in court. The only time when the accuracy of the written witness statement becomes relevant is when someone stands up in court and says he's a liar, and then of course you have to get the cross-examination done orally. The witness statements being part of the are not technically the basic evidence. The evidence is the oral evidence, so you could make someone stand up and read out his witness statement, and that would be the evidence. He'd be doing that on oath in front of a court, in front of the jury, if it was a jury trial.
That's the question. Are your cases going to be jury trials, or are they going to be bench trials?
I think that rather depends on how we bring them, because we are capable of bringing cases either as on indictment, i.e. as a felony, or on a summons, i.e. as a misdemeanor. And I think probably, depending on the size of the case, we might bring the first ones as summonses, but I think that, you know, it depends how serious it is. There are guidelines on these, they're called either way cases, there are guidelines on which way you have to choose, whether to lay an indictment or whether to serve a summons. And I'm afraid my criminal law is not good enough to tell you what the criteria are, but it does has.
But you'll learn.
But it has got to do with the seriousness of the offence, largely speaking. But if it's on indictment, then there's a right to a jury trial. So that is how we get in front of the jury. But there is no grand jury which decides whether or not the indictment or the information should be laid. That's done by the prosecuting authority, which is us, effectively.
Now when the person comes in and gives you this statement, which is then recorded, are they subject to perjury or some version of that for a false statement?
Yes. I mean, if they gave us a statement and then they stood up in the witness box and said, well, that's all rubbish, I didn't mean to say that at all, I'm denying it all, then we could produce the statement actually as evidence at that point. And we could say, well, actually, you made a previous inconsistent statement with what you're now saying. Will you please explain yourself in front of the jury?
But my point, and of course, this is the land of obstruction of justice and perjury as main themes of, you know, as going all the way back to the Watergate period. Can the person just comes in and says, there were no meetings, I didn't do it, and so forth. And it turns out you've now got a bunch of, you know, you've got some other people saying he was at the meeting.
Yep.
Can you indict him for both
charge him for both the antitrust violation, or if you're giving him a no-action letter, can you charge him with lying to you?
You could charge it, yes, for obstructing the investigation, yes.
Good. I've been asking too many of the questions. Yes, sir. Hey, why don't you come to the microphone and identify yourself?
The question is,
I take it is how far has the new legislation gone in saying that if you do something someplace in the world that produces injury in the United Kingdom, can the UK go and prosecute it?
I think there are three orders of answer to that. First of all, the blocking statutes are still on the statute book. I don't think they've been repealed, but we haven't used them. And I'm not sure we'll have to now because of the way the Empagran litigation has panned out. I think that's actually... Sorry. That's actually given effect to what we thought the law ought to be rather than what some people thought the law might be in the United States. Secondly, I think that the UK statute... the criminal cartel offence has to be either implemented in the UK or intended to be implemented in the UK for it to be caught by the Act. Now, that might be read as being an expression of the effects doctrine, but it's not clear to me that that is the case. I think we'll just have to wait and see when we get a case as to whether or not what implemented means. Does it mean it has an effect in, or does it mean the agreement has to have been made and directed towards the UK in some way, which I suspect it does. And thirdly, I think, you know, in relation to the effects doctrine, I think that no one was claiming that, at least we weren't claiming, I hope, that something with a vague effect in the UK might be a criminal offence in the UK. I think that there had to be something which was fairly concrete, bearing in mind this is a criminal offence. We have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the thing was having an effect in the UK. That's not easy to do.
Thank you.
I think sort of the short answer is not everyone in the world agrees with our view. Not every country takes our view. I guess it's viewed in the world as a fairly expansive view of our jurisdiction, and some countries I think would actively oppose it. For example, when we first brought the fax paper case, as I said, we were dismissed and we went up to the First Circuit, and then it was ultimately appealed to the Supreme Court. The government of Japan filed an amicus brief opposing our view of what they saw as an extraterritorial application of our law, and rejecting our effects theory, and they urged the court not to agree that we could have jurisdiction. But the court considered that, and the Supreme Court did not take cert, and they had also filed in the First Circuit, and they obviously did not find that persuasive. To the extent other countries take offense at what they may see as overreaching by the United States, we hope that over the course of time, when they see the positive benefits to the world economy of what we're trying to do, that we're not only trying to oftentimes, you know, global cartelists are hurting consumers in their own country. They may not have criminal laws, or it may not be a priority of that government to pursue that kind of violation, but we feel kind of good that by stopping a global cartel, we're also helping whatever country you're from, we're helping your consumers, because these cartels are hurting people all over the world. So we hope that over the course of time, more and more countries will come to see the positive benefits there are, and that there's no intent to be offensive to the other country. And we also, along those lines, have tried to draw a fairly narrow circle of the type of conduct that we pursue criminally, especially in an international extraterritorial application. It's very, what the OECD has recognized as hardcore criminal activity, price fixing, bid rigging, and customer or market allocation agreements. There's a broader circle of conduct that might be pursued criminally, but if we're going to impose our theory, our effects theory, we usually make sure it's very blatant, very serious, very clearly hardcore kind of conduct that has been recognized in international bodies as I said, as a serious offense that criminal sanctions are appropriate for.
I think the other part of his question was how different is our effects doctrine to what the European Commission is using in terms of pursuing things?
I think it's somewhat different, and in fact, we have a conference call with them tomorrow to discuss that very issue.
Okay,
so I don't know. I think they take a less aggressive view than we do, but there's a dialogue going on, and that's an evolving issue.
One of the things that I would observe is we put into this quote hardcore conduct. Guy sitting in a room, agreeing exactly on what the bids are or whatever it is. But when you get to geographic market allocation, it's often somewhat different. I mean, I'm running a business in the United States. Someone else is running a business in the UK. I don't have any particular need or urgent desire to go over there. You don't have any particular need or urgent desire over there. We know each other. We eat and drink and things, and we stay out of each other's country. There aren't the same kind of covert meetings, and I found that that one people were less sensitive to than what I'll call heavily administered price fixing and bid rigging cartels.
Yeah, that might be right. I mean, I think the more sort of blatant the evidence and more clear intent to be secretive and hide your cartel, more countries feel more comfortable about seeing us enforced more broadly.
Now, you have in your law, Vincent, a requirement that the government prove that the cartel players acted dishonestly.
Yes.
What's that mean?
That they knew that what they were doing was wrong, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, that, of course, might cause some difficulty with some of the smaller players who, frankly, have been doing this for some time. We look in the construction industry, for example. We've had some small house building cases, some roofing cases, where one of the defences was, we didn't know this was illegal, we've been doing it for 50 years. Now, as defences go, it has its drawbacks, but the one thing you can say for them, if you believe them, is that we need to educate business rather better about what a cartel is and what the harm does.
So there's been that recent flurry. I was actually in the UK when there were suddenly announcements from British Air that two senior officials were being suspended or whatever. I was talking that day to one of the directors of your enterprise, well-known professor, and he said there were people on the underground train reading over each other's shoulders the stories on British Air, which I take it that kind of thing, that high visibility public flogging, will make it harder for people to make dishonesty defenses going forward.
Yes, I mean, they will not be able to say they didn't know it was wrong because of the press coverage, and that's why we need, I think, rather more of these than perhaps we've been able to get in the past 2 or 3 years, so that people's awareness of the wrongness of what they're doing is increased. I think that one of the problems is that airline fuel surcharges is obvious, but some of the market sharing stuff in particular can be quite on the borderline, and actually trying to prove that someone knew that what they were doing was wrong when they were literally, as it were, serving their traditional customers or trying to ensure an orderly market and that kind of thing, which you see often in notes of meetings, is quite difficult.
Well, that's why I've raised, my instinct is you may have more trouble in some of the informal geographic market allocation cases than in the thing. Todd Miller.
I just want to ask a quick question about, obviously you're just starting your criminal investigation. What have you done to mention about the antitrust bar, lack of security in dealing with first amendment business? How are you with those getting the necessary experience to actually run the investigation? And just a quick second question, follow up on any predictions on when the fears of the gold
The answer to the last question is no. The answer to the first question is we tend to rely ourselves on the private bar, and we have a divided profession in England. So we have solicitors and barristers, and they are a separate set of professions rather than as here where you have just one set of attorneys. And the private bar are effectively like consultants to general practitioners, but we use them as well as the private litigants. So we do instruct criminal counsel, people who stand up in court and act on our behalf, and we intend to do that at least to get our expertise up to speed before trying to engage in too much doing it yourself, because we'll only get it wrong and we'll have egg on our faces and we'll do an injustice to someone. So we are actually instructing criminal counsel from an early stage to help us, to guide us in the investigation, in particular on what questions we can sensibly and properly ask, what we can do with the evidence, and how we should present our case.
Well, I hope the podcast audience in the United Kingdom has listened carefully to this last discussion, so that they're well aware of how bad it is, and that they will just be lucky
if they're prosecuted by you rather than extradited to me. Exactly. No, I want to, on behalf of the law school and those of us who sponsor this, I really want to thank you both for, you know, a wonderfully, to me, interesting occasion, and for personally, for just the great fun of getting a chance to listen to you. Thank you very, very much indeed. And I've decided to exercise my discretion and award you a pen.
Oh, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Treasure it, always. Beautiful. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Yes, thank you.